Even dying, his doctor said he was probably the most impossible patient I have ever known. He was constantly complaining in the most abusive manner to everyone about everything. He gave the nurses hell, he gave the junior medical staff hell, he never cooperated with our attempts to help him, etc. He told lies.
My favourite quote, Peter, from that I came across in the medical record was a young medical staff member who just scribbled across his chart, total body transplant recommended.
Because he was accident prone, and
very much, yes,
and a hypochondriac. He seems to spend a lot of years in a neck brace for various reasons, and he did have a terrible accident in the surf, which put him back, and put him into great pain. Interesting, the beach, which of course you know in our coastal nation, it's not an original observation, but that we sit around. You know, kind of on this veranda looking out to sea, clinging to the coast in Australia. And Glascon is very much about the beach. He described it as the beach at the end of the world. And you've cited Robert Drew, the writer, saying almost every rite of passion in Australia, rite of passage, rather, in Australia occurs on or near a beach. And ain't that the truth? Certainly for Glascon.
Oh, indeed it was. And that's why I started the book with a chapter called My Beautiful Beach, because it was the scene of many great moments in his life, some very low moments, and then when he died, his partner Leo Vanderpas took his ashes down to the groin at Cottesloe, and that's where he ended up. And I thought, well, if you had to choose a metaphor for Glascon's life, his beautiful beach would probably be one of the key ones. And I was also very lucky there to get Tim Winton's quote, because Tim, of course, has a great passion for the coast and and the West Coast. We happened to meet several years ago, and so I kept up a correspondence with him, and so I asked him if I could use that quote, and he very gladly agreed, and I thought, this is the perfect quote for this chapter.
Yes.
It's all about standing at the coast, looking west, getting my bearings, knowing who I am. And I thought, yes, that is so much the case with Gary Glascon.
I admire Winton because he's always been very honest about his influences. See, I think Cloud Street is Patrick White light. And I don't think a word of that could have been written without the influence of Patrick White. And he quite honestly said, yes, you're absolutely right. I couldn't agree more. And he also acknowledges the influence of Randolph Stowe.
He does.
Which I think is central to Glascon's life is his homosexuality. He had a long relationship with, what was his name,
Leo Vanderpas.
Yes, really his life partner.
And 22 years.
A very successful relationship, although I think not one without strains, which is hardly unusual. I think Leo was a very tolerant man.
Mm-hmm. Oh, indeed he was.
But this is coming. His life is at a period, and we forget this, John. And you quote the historian Graham Willett's description of 1950s Australian gay life as a scene of the night and very largely invisible to the rest of society. Its members hoped for nothing more than to be left alone. It eschewed, indeed never seriously imagined, political action, and what underpinned its apolitical stance was a fear, a deep and abiding fear of mainstream society. People went to jail for homosexuality. I knew of people who lamentably were jailed for. Now, we've come a long way in that this is a country which may embrace same-sex marriage, much as America has constitutionally now embraced marriage equality. But it was a very different time in which Glascon lived and wrote.
Oh, indeed it was. And he was part of what was the sort of underground gay spleen of the day, but not totally. He tended to mix in many circles. The gay community in Perth, which I was lucky enough to find several members of from his era, who gave me some wonderful descriptions of what went on. You know, the parties, the beach, the beats, everything. But totally under the radar, of course. He was a part of that, but he was also part of the art scene. He had business connections. He was a close friend to the former Premier of Western Australia, Sir Charles Court, of all people. He had a very wide-ranging series of overlapping networks, and of which the gay community was one.
But people were hiding in plain sight.
Yes, indeed they were. Yes, indeed.
Now, this, you're in a way part of this, John. I presume you're in your 50s?
I'm actually 65.
65. Now, you, to continue this, as, and it's part of the continuum, you, your work has been with aid agencies. You were working for an international NGO engaged in community and organisational development in India. Mm-hmm. You left Perth, which I think is probably a good idea. Funny place, Perth, John. You know, the half the time you're in Perth, you think, this is wonderful. This is heaven. And the other 50% of the time you think, get me out of here.
Exactly, yes.
It's odd, that, isn't it?
It is, and in a sense, that's a metaphor for the whole country. But Perth, it is a special place, and you know, it was wonderful in many ways growing up there in the 50s and 60s. But I used to sit on our front veranda and look at this big gum tree, and my mind would just go way, way beyond that, and I think, you know, when can I experience the rest of the world? And I actually got out in 71 and came across to the US, and the story goes on from there. But yes, I was in India in two periods, 76, 78, and then 80-84, and that was my life-changing time, was that latter period when I was there.
Whilst there, and you've written about this in a very affecting, very frank, candid memoir called The Boatman, An Indian Love Story, whilst there, you discovered your own sexuality.
Oh, yes, that was probably the most transformative part of a very transformative time.
In a country where homosexuality was illegal and difficult, you pursued a kind of bacchanalia, really, didn't you?
Well, once I got going, I did. It took me, you know, I'm always a little slow out of the block. and I sort of found myself on this roller coaster of sexual adventuring that went almost nonstop for about 2 or 3 years before I was finally assigned out of the country. And just in time, because AIDS had made its presence felt, and if I'd stayed maybe another 6 months even, I may not be talking to you on the phone.
It was a secret life too, wasn't it?
Oh, totally.
Yes.
And it was secret in two ways. There was no public face to the gay community in India at that time. There is now. There are clubs, there are support groups, there are magazines, etc. But in the 80s, when I was there, it was totally subterranean.
Clandestine.
Clandestine, absolutely. And as I tell the story, it started on a famous Bombay beach called Chapati Beach.
Yes.
And it started with the amateur masseurs, and it went from there. And I just, once I tapped into this secret world, everywhere I went in India, I was able to connect with it, sometimes just by chance, and being able to guess where to go and who to meet, sometimes with a referral. It was always one-to-one. You know, someone in Bombay would refer you to a friend of a cousin in Calcutta, and that was all you need. And once you got there, you'd take off and you'd find this mammoth network of people.
And you made friends.
I made some very good friends.
And also you found yourself.
Well, indeed. It took me a while, and it was difficult because the other thing I was going to mention earlier was that I was living in a communal setting. This NGO that I was with was a bit like a cross between the Peace Corps and a religious order. We had a very intense community life, and we lived and worked in the same premises. And it was a fishbowl. You know, everyone sort of knew what everyone else was doing. There was no oral privacy. There was minimal visual privacy and all that. So I was sort of under the gaze of my neighbor. And it got to be quite difficult at times. And I think some of my colleagues sensed what was going on. Most probably did not. And until one dear British woman who was our staff member in Calcutta got me aside one night and said, "Hey, John, my husband and I have noticed your nocturnal disappearances, and we've come to the conclusion that either, one, you work for the CIA, or two, you're gay. So which is it?"
Might have been both.
Well, who knows, but he was the one that finally allowed me to step back from about 2 years of very intense personal secret exploration and share, and from that point on I was able to talk with a few others.
Robert Desai has said, you know, what I think in the book about André Gide, he says, you know, what's the point? There's a great deal of sexual adventure in travel. What's the point of travel without sexual adventure?
Yes, and, he does say that in that book.
And I think he has a point there, and certainly you're living proof of a kind of the kind of intoxication of a foreigner in a foreign, a stranger in a strange land. You found yourself, and this would never have happened if you'd stayed in Perth.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Perth for me in the 50s and 60s, where I grew up there, I was in a very middle-class, suburban, Christian family, and I had no inkling that there was such a thing as a gay community. I didn't really know what gay was. I did have, you know, friends. I had one high school teacher who sort of hinted strongly that perhaps that was who I was, but it never went any further than that. And it took India with its bewildering complexity and chaos and its richness, because it's just so diverse in every sense of the word. But it took India to kind of unshackle me from that upbringing and to dare to explore that there might be another part of myself that I hadn't even woken up to.
And to become, your life became a liberation.
Oh, indeed it did.
And it's an engrossing story, a beautifully told. What's your next book, John?
Well, there is a third one that's on the back burner, if I can get some time to work on it. It's just a series of travel anecdotes, speaking about travel. I've been to more than 40 countries around the world, and I've met some amazing people and had some interesting experiences, not just in India. And so I've done some work on this, but it still needs a lot more finessing. And I've given it the tentative title of "More Than Halfway to Somewhere."
I like that.
hopefully we'll see the light of day in the next year or so.
John, I thank you for your books. particularly The Boatman, your current memoir and your biography of Gerald Glascon, Dare Me. And I thank you very much for giving us Glascon back, perhaps, and for your frankness and your fine writing. Thank you very much, John, and I wish you well, and I look forward to that next book.
Well, thank you, Peter. It's been a pleasure and an honour.